Job 14. Man who is born of woman is short-lived and full of turmoil. Like a flower he comes forth and withers. He also flees like a shadow and does not remain. Thou also dost open thine eyes on him and bring him into judgment with thyself. Who can make the clean out of the unclean? No one. Since his days are determined, the number of his months is with thee, and his limits thou hast set, so that he cannot pass. Turn your gaze from him that he may rest, until he fulfills his days like a hired man. For there is hope for a tree, when it is cut down, that it will sprout again, and its shoots will not fail. Though its roots grow old in the ground, and its stump dies in the dry soil, at the scent of water it will flourish and put forth sprigs like a plant. But a man dies and lies prostrate. Man expires, and where is he? As water evaporates from the sea, and the river becomes parched and dried up, so a man lies down and does not rise, until the heavens be no more. He will not awake, nor be aroused out of his sleep. Oh, that thou wouldst hide me in Sheol, that thou wouldst conceal me until thy wrath returns to thee, that thou wouldst set a limit for me and remember me. If a man dies, will he live again? All the days of my struggle I will wait until my change comes. Thou wilt call and I will answer thee. Thou wilt long for the work of thy hands. For now thou dost number my steps. Thou dost not observe my sin. My transgression is sealed up in a bag, and thou dost wrap me up in iniquity. But the falling mountain crumbles away, and the rock moves from its place. Water wears away stones, its torrents wash away the dust of the earth, so thou dost destroy man's hope. Thou dost forever overpower him, and he departs. Thou dost change his appearance and send him away. His sons achieve honor, but he does not know it. Or they become insignificant, but he does not perceive it. But his body pains him, and he mourns only for himself. May God bless his word to our hearts and minds. In the last days, says the Apostle Paul, men will be lovers of self and lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. The love of self and the love of pleasure is not unique to the last days, of course. Since the fall of Adam, that has been true. I think the reason for the apostle's emphasis is due to the fact that in the last days, men will abandon themselves to the pursuit of pleasure. One needs to watch only a few minutes of television to realize how accurately the apostle has described the days in which we live. Truly, the world today is intoxicated in the pursuit of selfish pleasure. Sad to say, the church has been greatly influenced by the world. And in many places, the worship of God must be entertaining and pleasurable to the senses, or it is unacceptable. When the objective in life is the pursuit of pleasure, the result is frustration because it is an unattainable objective. In another connection recently, I quoted from Dr. Viktor Frankl, that eminent Swiss physician and clinical psychologist, who said, "The will to pleasure is a self-defeating principle. Inasmuch as the more a person really sets out to strive for pleasure, the less likely he is to gain it. For pleasure is the byproduct or side effect of the fulfillment of our strivings." End of quote. In other words, those who make pleasure their goal make the mistake of seeking the effect, rather than the cause. For example, contrary to current popular opinion, pleasure comes as the result of a job well done. Consider some of the engineers over here at Boeing who design and build the latest aircraft. And when that engineer who has formulated the whole plan in his mind, has put it on the drawing board, when the job is complete, he is able to stand there at the edge of the runway and watch the Henry and the flight crew put it through rigorous and demanding tests, and when it proves that it is reliable and that it is able to do the expected performance, the engineer has the pleasure that his work has been well done, that his work has been good. I remind you that when God created the world, He stood back, as it were, and He observed it, and He pronounced it good. But you see, the achievement of an objective produces the pleasure. You take away the work that is involved in making an aircraft, there is no plane and there is no pleasure, no matter how much that engineer might try to generate that pleasure in himself. There is pleasure in personal relationships. But one must work on those relationships to enjoy the pleasure. When a person works on the pleasure, as so many do in our society today, the relationship just disintegrates. Since pleasure is the byproduct or the side effect of the fulfillment of our strivings, we need to consider carefully our objectives in life. What are you striving to achieve? What are you endeavoring to fulfill in your life? What do you want to accomplish? What objective do you have in life which, when achieved, will bring you satisfaction and pleasure? In gathering the foundational facts which we need to know in order to find meaning in life, we have already considered the fact that man is made by God. That concerns the question, how? How did this creature come into being? How did man begin? Well, the answer from the scriptures is quite clear. He was made by God. And having been made by God, he therefore has a sensible origin. We considered, secondly, the fact that man is made like God. That concerns the question, what? What is man? What is this creature? Having been made in God's image, man is unique in that among all the creation, all the creatures that God has made, man alone has the ability to communicate with his Maker. Now, as we come to the third consideration concerning man, we must answer the question, why? Why did God make man like himself? When God made man, what purpose did he have in view? And if true pleasure and satisfaction on our part depend upon the fulfillment of the purpose for which God made us, it is imperative that we discover what that purpose is and that we endeavor to fulfill it. When I discussed the question of origins, I mentioned that Professor Harvey Cox at Harvard, who incidentally last Sunday as I was home in bed and I watched one of those news programs of David Brinkley, in which he interviewed Professor Harvey Cox, who happened to be here in Seattle. And he was interviewing him about the scandal that has taken place recently with Jimmy Baker. And he was interviewing various people, but I must say that Professor Cox was very articulate and and defended the evangelical cause, though he's not an evangelical by any means, yet he stood up for us and he said that people ought to be supporting their local church rather than these great empires that are unable to help people in their time of need. But at any rate, I mentioned that Professor Cox endeavors to find a logic in the evolutionary process by appealing to the complex theories of Teilhard de Chardin. Now, Professor Cox knows that it is imperative to have a meaningful origin if our life right now is to have any meaning or significance. He knows also that a meaningful life not only depends on a meaningful origin, but on a meaningful destiny. And having abandoned the only infallible guide in such basic matters, Cox tries to construct a meaningful destiny from the ideas of a man named Ernest Bloch, a Marxist. Where is the human race going? Cox anticipates the day when Christianity and communism will be blended together into consistent Christian atheism. Now, a few years ago, such thoughts and ideas would have been unthinkable. Today, however, with the advent of liberation theology, Christianity and communism, at least Christianity in name, and communism have been wedded. In Central and South America, it is already a reality. The ultimate answer to the problems in Central America is not more financial aid or military might, but the preaching of the gospel of Jesus Christ as it is taught in the Scriptures. The gospel alone provides men with a sure hope and a meaningful future. And the church in the United States needs to understand the fact that the problems on our doorstep are not first and foremost political or economical, but theological. At any rate, be that as it may, Professor Cox looks for a meaningful destiny in the marriage of Christianity and communism. I believe that the Bible provides us with a far more satisfactory and meaningful future and destiny. You must understand, of course, that your perspective on the present is conditioned and governed by your concept of the future. Dr. G. Campbell Morgan once said, "No man can really live who does not see himself as having a future." That is true in every aspect of life. Recently, I spoke with a young man who is settled into a good occupation, but who has decided to go back to school to prepare for something entirely different because he sees no future in what he's doing. Many marriages end up in divorce because one or both of the partners see no future in their relationship. Many a person has committed suicide because he has come to the end of his rope, as we say, and he sees no future in life itself. In every area of life, a person needs to know that he is going somewhere, that he is moving towards a meaningful destiny. Let me ask you again, do you know where you're going? Do you know what your purpose is in life? Do you have a hope that is before you, which you expect to achieve? Psalm 73, to which you may turn, was written by a man named Asaph. Excuse me. Psalm 73 was written by Asaph. He tells us that he was envious of the wicked when he saw how much they prospered. And if you read the early verses of that psalm, you will notice that the wicked blasphemed God and they cursed their fellow man, and nothing bad ever seemed to happen to them. When it came for their time to die, the wicked lied down and died in peace. And Asaph had just about reached the conclusion that it does not pay to live a righteous life. He was about to abandon his convictions until in verse 17 he says, I went into the sanctuary of God and understood their latter end. Asaph tells us that when he envied the wicked, verse 2, that his steps had almost slipped. When he understood the latter end of the wicked, he realized, however, in verse 18, that they were the ones who were standing on slippery places. Asaph understood that they would be cast down to destruction and destroyed in a moment. Verses 18 and 19. When Asaph went into the sanctuary of God, when he regained a proper perspective on the future, he realized how senseless it was to envy the wicked. And on the other hand, he realized how wonderful it was to be held in God's right hand. When he went into the sanctuary and regained a proper perspective on the future, he was thankful that God guides with his counsel. As he says in verse 24, and afterwards receives his servants into glory. Asaph's understanding of the future changed his outlook on the present. Because Asaph had a meaningful destiny, his present life had meaning. We've already learned from Job that life is brief. And because life is brief, we need to use our time wisely. And to use our time wisely, we need to know that we are moving in the right direction towards the right objective. We need to have a sure and a certain hope set before us. As Job suffered, what did the future hold for him? How did Job's view of the future relate to his present? At the outset of chapter 14, the chapter we read, he reminds us again that life is short. Verse 1, man who is born of woman is short-lived and full of turmoil. Like a flower he comes forth and withers. He also flees like a shadow and does not remain. Life is soon over. What hope does a man have? Does he have any future? Well, come down to verse 7 and consider where Job really struggles with this question. He says in verse 7, for there is hope for a tree when it is cut down that it will sprout again, and its shoots will not fail, though its roots grow old in the ground and its stump dies in the dry soil. At the scent of water it will flourish and put forth sprigs like a plant. But a man dies, and he lies prostrate. Man expires, and where is he? Verse 14, he asks the question, if a man dies, will he live again? You'll notice that the word again is italicized. That means it has been supplied by the translators, and undoubtedly the word is necessary, but it does tend to obscure the point of Job's question. Job's question really is, if a man dies, will he live? Is there a future for man beyond death? If you cut down a tree, it will sprout again. But you cut down a man, and where is he? If a man dies and that's all there is, if there is no future beyond death, then trees have more hope than men do. Man begins as a beautiful flower. In a short time he fades and is gone.
If that's all that man has to look forward to, the sooner he fades, the better. In spite of the fact that modern man has reached the conclusion that there is no future beyond the grave, somehow that explanation just does not satisfy. There's something terribly wrong when trees have hope, but men just die. Job asks, if a man dies, will he live? Is there life beyond the grave? Does a man have future beyond death to which he can look forward in hope and anticipation? Oh, Job's question is not left unanswered. You'll notice verse 14 goes on to say, all the days of my struggle I will wait until my change comes. In other words, since there is life beyond the grave, Job will wait patiently for it. The present life, no matter how difficult it is to be lived with a future in view. Nevertheless, that's easier said than done. Job was suffering. His agony was intense, and it seems to drag on endlessly. The reality of Job's present affliction tends to obscure the future. It is so difficult sometimes to look beyond the harsh realities of the present. Notice Job's statement in verse 18. The falling mountain crumbles away, and the rock moves from its place. Water wears away stones, its torrents wash away the dust of the earth. So thou dost destroy man's hope. Consider also his statements in chapter 17. Chapter 17 and verse 1. He says, my spirit is broken, my days are extinguished, the grave is ready for me. Verse 11, chapter 17. My days are past, my plans are torn apart, even the wishes of my heart. Verse 13, if I look for Sheol, or I think that means there the grave, if I look for the grave as my home, I make my bed in the darkness. The New International Version translates verse 13 as follows, if the only home I hope for is the grave, if I spread out my bed in darkness, verse 15, where then is my hope? Poor Job, as he wrote these verses, these words, he was deeply depressed. He saw no future in all of his suffering. The problems that have come upon him have destroyed his plans, and he looks forward to the time when he can just lie down and die. If suffering and adversity is all that there is, let it be over and done with. I'm sure that you have met many people like that who long to be released from suffering, from their circumstances, because they see no future and they resign themselves to the grave. True faith, however, cannot be chained by giant despair and held in doubting castle for long. True faith cannot waver long because it rests upon certainties. And ere long, Job grasped the key of faith and he unlocked those iron gates of Doubting Castle and his spirit soared to the very heights of heaven. Listen to those familiar words in chapter 19 from the New International Version where he says, I know that my Redeemer liveth and at the end he will stand upon the earth and after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes, I and not another. Oh, how my heart yearns within me. Job's hope and his faith does not rest upon fables and old wives' tales. It rests upon the certainty of the resurrection. If a man dies, shall he live? Is there a future beyond the grave? Oh, indeed there is. And Job says, though this skin be destroyed, yet all those who know the Redeemer will see him with their eyes. What a glorious and triumphant prospect every believer has. Ponder also the words of the apostle from 1 Corinthians 15, that great resurrection chapter. Excuse me. Verses 51 and following. Behold, I tell you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trump, for the trumpet will sound, and the dead will be raised incorruptible or imperishable, and we shall be changed. For this perishable must put on the imperishable, and this mortal must put on immortality. But when this perishable will have put on the imperishable, and this mortal will have put on immortality, then will come about the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting? Thanks be to God who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. The hope of every believer is that there will come a day when he will be clothed in immortality. The realization that death is not the end, but rather one's entrance into glory, makes the future a wonderful prospect indeed. The anticipation of that glorious day, Job was able to look beyond his immediate circumstances and his suffering. Job's hope for the future changed his outlook on the present. The hope of seeing his Redeemer face to face made life bearable. The prospect of seeing his Lord brought meaning to his present existence. Does not the Apostle Peter say also, in this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while you may have had to suffer grief in all kinds of trials? And later in that same first epistle he says, rejoice that you may participate in the sufferings of Christ, so that you may be overjoyed when his glory is revealed. Oh, death is not the end. Believers have a sure and a certain hope. Peter calls it in that epistle, the living hope. It's no wonder, is it, that Handel, in composing that oratorial masterpiece, The Messiah, places the words of Job alongside the doxology of the book of Revelation when he says, I know that my Redeemer liveth, worthy is the Lamb to receive glory. What a glorious prospect it is for Christians to stand in the presence of their Lord who purchased them with his own blood and washed them from their sins. Of course, for those who have never embraced Jesus Christ as Savior, the prospects are dismal indeed. They have nothing to look forward to except remorse and endless punishment for their sins. Oh, let me urge you this morning to make sure of your calling and election. My point, however, is that for the believer, there is something more than this life. Something to look forward to. For the believer, there is more than just standing in the presence of the Lord. Excuse me. As wonderful a prospect as that is. When believers stand in the presence of the Lord and are changed into his likeness, then the purpose for which we were made will be fully realized. Now that does not mean, of course, that we do not understand anything of that purpose now. We know something of God's purpose for our lives, but because of the presence of sin and the limitations of our fallen humanity, we are unable to fulfill completely the purpose for which God made us. When we are redeemed from the very presence of sin, then we will fulfill God's purpose fully and completely. But what was the purpose for which God made Job? For what purpose has God made you? In introducing us to Job, God tells us that Job was the greatest man in the East. He was wealthy and he was influential. Was God's purpose for Job simply to make him the greatest man in the East? Now, as you look around our society, obviously that is the purpose of many people, to become the greatest. Many people would love to be known as the greatest person in the city of Seattle, or in the state of Washington, or in the United States, or in the entire world. Some people would give everything to be known as the greatest. But does God make men for that purpose? If in God's providence you were to become the wealthiest and most powerful person in all the world, you would need to be especially careful lest you made wealth, power, and influence the end and the purpose of your life. Because God did not make you to be great. He did not make you to be wealthy. That is not the chief end of man. In response to Satan's wanderings around the earth, God said to him, you remember from chapter 1, "Have you considered my servant Job?" In describing Job as my servant, God tells us a great deal about this man. As we have seen, Job was wealthy. He was influential. But how did he use his wealth? How did he use his influence? Because God declared Job to be his servant, I believe we may safely say that Job used his wealth and his influence to serve God. Job used the resources and the abilities that God had given to him faithfully and responsibly. Job was a good steward. What did Job do when he lost his possessions and his influence? Well, you remember from chapter 1 again that when he learned of all this, he fell to the ground and he worshipped. With all his possessions, he worshipped and served God. When he lost his possessions, what did he do? He worshipped and he served God. It's important to remember that there is a direct relationship between worship and service. This is seen, first of all, in the second commandment, where men are forbidden to worship and serve idols. And you will remember that when Satan took Jesus up onto a high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world, he said to him, "If you will just bow down and worship me, I will give you all these kingdoms." Satan said nothing about service, he just mentioned worship. "You bow down and worship, and I'll give you." Jesus put things back into their proper perspective when he said, "Begone, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God and serve him only." Jesus knew that worship and service cannot be separated. Job's service was inseparably linked to his worship. When he had possessions, he worshipped and served. When he lost his possessions, he worshipped and served. And though Job's circumstances changed dramatically, he found himself afflicted and destitute, his purpose in life had not changed. He continued to worship and serve God. And if suffering and adversity is involved in serving God, Job will bear it. And he bore it willingly because he recognized the worth of his God. Consider the Apostle Paul's words, Romans chapter 5, when he says, "We exalt in hope of the glory of God. And not only this, but we exalt in our tribulations, knowing that tribulation brings about perseverance, and perseverance proven character, and proven character hope. And hope does not disappoint, because the love of God is poured out within our hearts." Or his statement in 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 10, "I am well content with weaknesses, with insults, with distresses, with persecutions, with difficulties, for Christ's sake." He was able to endure all these things because he worshipped God. Consider also our Lord, who, as the prophet said, would see the anguish of his soul and be satisfied. Job, the Apostle Paul, our Lord Jesus, and many, many others were able to bear hardship and suffering because they knew that there was and is a purpose in it all. The problems of life take on an entirely different appearance when we understand that God does indeed cause all things to work together for the good of those who love God, for those who are called according to His purpose. As our catechism says, man's chief purpose is to serve or glorify God. God is not glorified through dramatic or sensational things that we might say or do. Rather, He is glorified through faithful, patient service. Peter, you'll remember, boasted of the fact that he would follow the Lord even unto death. But when the time came, he denied his Lord and forsook him and fled. Faith can boast of great things when it is untried. When it is tried, it is proved by obedience. Trial and adversity will either prove one's faith, the reality of faith, or the lack of faith. That which enabled Job to bear affliction and to endure suffering was the knowledge that he was serving God. And that one day he would be released from his sorrow and pain to serve God in his presence, where there is fullness of joy and at whose right hand there are pleasures forevermore. And when Job was released from the miseries of this life, and when he stood in God's presence, what did he do? He worshipped and served God. In other words, the purpose for which God had made Job, the purpose for which God has made you, is to glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. God has made man for Himself. He made man to worship and serve Him forever. When we discover that truth, life becomes meaningful. So then, we have considered three foundational facts. First of all, man is made by God. He has, therefore, a meaningful origin. Secondly, he is made like God. He has, therefore, at least the possibility of a meaningful relationship with God. And thirdly, man is made for God. We were made to worship and serve our Creator. Life was meant to be wonderful. Life was meant to be filled with meaning. It was meant to be satisfying. It was meant to be fulfilling. It was meant to be pleasurable. Many people, however, are anxious and frustrated. Many are confused and baffled. Many are depressed and defeated because they do not understand these basic facts which relate to the meaning of their existence. Now, while the emphasis of these studies has been on man, in one sense, they've not been on man at all. They've been on God. It all depends really where you put the emphasis. You see, we could say that man has been made by God. He's been made like God. He's been made for God. And I make that emphasis simply to point out to you that life for man is meaningful and satisfying only as it relates to God. You were made to worship and serve your Maker. And though that will involve, to some extent, the miseries of this life, you must not forget that this life is not the end. All those who have set their hope in God have a glorious future. They have a meaningful destiny, and that destiny is to enjoy their Maker forever. When you understand that in God's presence is fullness of joy, and at His right hand there are pleasures forevermore, you can know that and face the adversities of this life objectively, knowing that they are but for a moment, and that they are but a preparation for one's entrance into glory. Your concept of the future affects your outlook on the present. In the last days, says the Apostle Paul, men will be lovers of self and lovers of pleasure. Because, you see, their hope is not set on the living God. In knowing God, the Christian has a hope for the future. which brings him joy in the midst of suffering and hardship and trial. Let us pray.